This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The algorithms that operate our computers are used in many aspects of our lives, from online retailing to internet searches and on stock exchanges around the world. They're used to decide who gets a job interview, who gets granted parole, and who gets a loan in a lot of instances. But since they're written by people, there are concerns that algorithms can reinforce the prejudices of their creators with serious consequences. Joining us to discuss biased algorithms and their potential effects on society, our supervisor of technology with St. Elizabeth Healthcare, Phil Horney. Good afternoon, Phil.
Howdy.
Software architect and developer Dave Hatter. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Mark.
And Kathy Rubin, founder of CM Rubin World, an online publishing company focused on education, entertainment, and lifestyle, including the impact of innovation and technology. Kathy, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Dave, just a quick explanation for those of us who aren't technically inclined. What is an algorithm? Is that the same thing as software, basically? Or?
Well, I would call it a subset of software. It's fancy programmer speak for instructions that the programmer writes that tells the computer to do something. So it's really just a set of specific instructions.
And the usage of these things, as I was noting, is really widespread.
Yeah, pretty much every software in the world ultimately breaks down to algorithms that enforce the rules in that the software is trying to do. You know, whatever the software is built to do, it's the algorithms inside it that make it do that.
And Phil, how complicated can these things become?
Well, I mean, they can become giant. We've read about some of these algorithms that are referred to as spaghetti code, which means that there's just so many instructions that a normal person couldn't even understand them just by looking at them.
Kathy, how we talk about biased algorithms, how does mm-hmm. bias creep into an algorithm? How does that happen?
Basically, whoever is programming the algorithm is determining what goes in and what stays out. So that's where the bias, you know, can come. Everybody has, you know, human beings are, you know, have, you know, their own sort of agendas, their own motives. So you know, that's where it creeps in. But I would just like to say that, you know, I was speaking to some students the other day who were doing their master's in education, and they pointed out to me that, you know, in the age of, you know, textbooks and, you know, publishing in the textbook world, there were a lot of discussions and still are about the bias in textbooks. I think the differences between, textbooks and the kinds of, machines that we're dealing with today is the potential for problems being, you know, much bigger. So the bias creeps in basically because whoever is programming the algorithm makes the decision on what, you know, how it's designed and what it's going to actually contain.
You think a lot of that's...
Am I right, guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that.
You think a lot of it's deliberate, or is it just inadvertent?
Well, I think a lot of the biases that people have are experiential. So, you know, as a person develops, they, you know, build these biases within themselves, and they may not necessarily understand that they have these biases. So when they're doing these programming things, they're not necessarily aware that they're building biases into whatever it is they're writing.
And I think it could be even more subtle than that. I mean, certainly you could start out with an explicit bias and build a software in such a way that it's predetermined to take a certain path, and that can be difficult to determine. That's one of the things that makes this tricky is, to Phil's point earlier, you may have tens of millions of lines of code. It's completely unknowable what every single possible state it could ever be in is, so these things can be difficult to determine. So you may have an explicit attempt to build bias in, or it may be more of a sin of omission thing where you've overlooked certain things, or perhaps when you get into things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, the data sets that you're using, you may not have any intent to put bias into the process, but because of the data the algorithms consume is ultimately biased in some direction, there is bias that exists ultimately in the output of the algorithm, and that can be extremely difficult to find. And that's part of the trick of this. It's not necessarily that people are doing this on purpose. It's that it's happening, and you don't even know that it's happening. And it's difficult to uncover because these systems are so complex.
So what's the difference, Dave, between – and Kathy, go right ahead. I'll come back to this question. You were going to say something.
Well, I had I had a question for Dave. I mean, right now, you know, as the AI is being built, I'm sure that it's a very complex process, as you just explained. But there must be checks and balances. There must be basically steps that are in place even now to ensure that things are done in the proper fashion. Or am I just totally naive?
Well, I don't know if I'd go as far as to say naive, but I would first off want to qualify my answer by saying I don't pretend to be any kind of AI expert. I'm just a poor software developer type. But I think part of the issue is, what is the financial incentive for a company that's building artificial intelligence to ensure that this sort of bias isn't in the system? And then again, if you're building systems that can learn on their own, machine learning, artificial intelligence, essentially sort of the same thing to some extent, as it learns on its own and it uses more data, consumes data from new data sets and so forth, how can you even know that the data itself might be biased even if the algorithm isn't? So I'm not sure that anyone is purposely doing this necessarily, but I think it's extremely difficult to uncover. And I'm not sure that there's much of an incentive for many companies in this space to really spend a lot of time trying to solve that at the moment.
Yeah, and I would agree.
Interesting.
You know, and a lot of these algorithms learn the same way that a student might learn. So a person has to provide the data to the algorithm to teach it how to behave in a certain way. And so let's look at Google, whose algorithms you use every day and whose algorithms many students use every day. You know, they currently have a lawsuit going on from James Damore that there is bias within the organization. So how is Google as an organization ensuring that that bias doesn't get into their algorithms? I don't know. And I'm not sure that there are even any effective methods for them to do that right now.
Dave, is there a difference today between the software that's coming out today, the algorithms that are being used today, and something that was maybe came out 20 years, 25 years ago?
Well, I think the difference is you have systems that are much more complex than they used to be because the amount of functionality they provide is substantially greater. And again, you get into this, well, it takes more instructions, more algorithms to create that functionality. As it gets more dense and more complex, it's basically unknowable every state that it could be in at any given time. There's a scenario a few years ago where a Toyota accelerated out of control, someone was killed, a lawsuit was filed. It took a team of 10 experts 18 months to get through all the code. It was something like 3 million lines. And they ultimately came to the conclusion that, to Phil's point, the code was spaghetti. You know, it had sort of, through the process of accretion, just built up and built up and built up and built up. And there was no way to even necessarily know every single path that the car could take down a certain route of code to cause this unintended acceleration. And eventually there was a big jury award in that. So the complexity of the systems keeps increasing. The complexity of the software keeps increasing. The systems are increasingly interconnected with one another. System A talks to System B. System A may not necessarily have any sort of bias in it, but the information it gets from System B, to Phil's point, that it's using to make its behaviors and so forth, is somehow biased. And then you get into a scenario also where the data, you know, 20 years ago, you didn't have these massive data sets, you know, the big data that you have now that's being used to feed these algorithms so they can learn. So yeah, things are much different now than they were 20 years ago. And the power of the systems, the actual raw hardware power that makes all of this possible, is obviously exponentially greater than it was 20 years ago. So, you know, we're rapidly entering into some unknown territory. And I guess that's why I find this concerning. You know, there's so many facets of this that could potentially backfire on us somehow.
Right.
Kathy,
I'm just so glad we're talking about it because, you know, everything you said, I, you know, sort of freaked me out the first time I started having conversations with people about this. But I can't remember where I read. It's very interesting. Somebody said, in every industrial revolution, you know, we're in the fourth industrial revolution, but in every past industrial revolution, it's been a race between tech and human capacity. And, you know, the bottom line is humans need to stay in control. You know, that's the only way we all get through this and we don't see the end of civilization. Right? I think the fourth industrial revolution, as you so well articulated, is scarier in many ways because of, you know, it's not just the technology we're dealing with, but it's the speed at which everything is changing so fast. But, you know, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be having conversations about it. you know, putting in place the same checks and balances that were put in place for previous technological disruptions in the past. You know, it just has to be done. And that's, you know, from my perspective, you know, my work is all about the future we want for youth. What kind of a future do we want for our children? You know, we don't want them to be the part of the end of civilization. I do want them to have better intelligences. I do want them to be able to improve their world. I do want them to be able to cure incurable diseases. And these are some of the fantastic opportunities we have with where we're going. But, you know, it's a question of how we, you know, how we remain in control as human beings.
Kathy, since CM Rubin World deals a lot, your focus is on education. I was just wondering, how do you see algorithms and artificial intelligence adapting to ever-changing, ever-evolving education systems?
That's a great question. It's something I've covered for 7 years. The impact of this technology we're talking about really requires us to rethink everything. You know, what is an education? What is a relevant education for the world? You know, these kids, you know, kids that are going to school now, you know, are going to be living in. What, you know, what are the competencies? What are the skills? What will they need? And I don't just mean for jobs. Of course, jobs are going to be automated, and we can, you know, we've seen lists and lists of jobs that are going to disappear, and they're from every domain and every profession. But it's not just that. How do you flourish? How do you, how do you succeed in this new world? You know, most of us are just guessing what it's going to be like. So, you know, a lot of our work now is really trying to bridge that gap between the education I grew up with, you guys grew up with, and the education that's relevant for the world our kids are moving into. And of course, the technological disruption, AI and these algorithms we're talking about have huge potential for making learning more accessible, which is great, for improving learning, for leveling the playing field, for kids with all kinds of learning issues that, you know, no longer become learning issues because, yeah, you know, the technology makes it personalized.
Yeah, so there's a lot of opportunities that go along with the challenges.
Yeah, I think
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree. And I feel like we're on the cusp of something really fantastic or really terrible. It could be really fantastic in that we, as you said, implement all the checks and balances that we need to eliminate bias from the algorithms and how your information is delivered to you, or really terrible in that if these biases aren't removed, that they just become an amplifier for existing biases that a person might have when they encounter this biased data.
But are much more difficult to find and ferret out and eliminate. Yeah, I agree with Phil. You know, this could all go really well, or it could all go really bad. And, you know, I hate to be the Davy Downer here, but, you know.
Go right ahead.
The whole potential Skynet is aware, you know, and Terminator-type future. While I think most people, when that movie came out, myself included, because I was in, like, 10th grade, seemed completely ridiculous and fantastic and not possible. And I'm not suggesting that's where we're going to end up here. But, you know, you don't have to go too far to look up, like, Big Dog, for example, or Atlas, robots from Boston Dynamics, which Google bought. If you see the capability of these things, which I don't think most people have seen, it's quite astounding. It's much more capable than most people would realize. You've got guys like Bill Gates and Elon Musk out there warning about the potential consequences of AI should it go wrong. There's a great book for anyone that's interested called Superintelligence. I highly recommend it. It's going to be a very interesting future. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. And, you know, Dave, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that, I agree with everything you're saying. I mean, what I'd like to see happen this time round, perhaps it didn't happen in the past, is I'd like to see more voices involved. I mean, you know, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I just think it's a much bigger problem than, you know, may have been faced in previous generations in terms of, you know, who are the voices that should be talking about this, reflecting on this, helping to make the decisions on this. I just feel that, you know, it should be as many voices as possible. It should be youth, students, it's their world, educators, you know, thought leaders, the normal people you would bring to the table. But I also think the more voices you can include, the better. And which is why, you know, in our work, we're trying to do as much as we can to educate youth and educate teachers and about, you know, what this means for the world.
Yeah. And Dave, you know, you're an educator, so you can kind of understand this. Mm-hmm. As a person, you can maybe see and understand your own biases and remove those from whatever it is you're instructing on. But once you introduce the machine element, that gets very difficult to do unless the data sets that you're providing are broad enough to eliminate that sort of thing.
It's a tricky problem for sure, and one that I don't know that there are enormous numbers of people putting a lot of thought into.
Why do you think that's the case? Why aren't more people concerned about this, Dave?
Well, I think for two reasons. The folks that are actively pursuing this technology, as I mentioned before, don't necessarily have a financial incentive to worry about this, right? They want to be first to market. They want to sell product, et cetera. So I'm not sure it's top of mind. And I think secondarily, when you look at society as a whole, most people don't really understand this technology. I don't think they understand how it could impact the future for them, good or bad. And there's no real governmental influence at this point in this space. So you have some, you know, fairly well-known people, again, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, folks like that, talking about it, potentially warning about it. But I'm not sure to the average person on the street it really means anything yet. Or if they even are aware of it, it's just some fanciful thing they saw, you know, an Altered Carbon or Black Mirror or some show on TV.
You think it's a case of it's happened so, at such a gradual pace, too, that people are just, they become used to it more and more, and this is just kind of the norm to them nowadays?
Yeah, maybe. I think it's been gradual until recently, but the pace is starting to accelerate fairly quickly. Again, I would encourage folks to just go out and Google things like, and you can decide for yourself if Google's algorithm is biased. You know, there are many complaints about Google. I won't even go down that path. But just Google, like I say, Big Dog, and look at some of the robotics that are out there now. It's pretty incredible what these things can do, and I would predict that the average person on the street has no idea. And, of course, this is what is known to the public. Who knows what they've got in some lab somewhere at the DOD or NSA? You know, this is what you can see just by going out and looking at the commercial aspects of these robots. So it's pretty interesting and somewhat spooky.
What do you think, Phil?
Yeah. Well, look, Kathy, she sounds like she's got some.
Okay, go ahead, Kathy.
No. I'm agreeing with you. I'm agreeing with you. And it comes back, and it comes back to this, you know, spreading the word, education, you know, helping people to understand it, so that we don't just have a handful of people who, you know, can profit from it, you know, sort of moving it along at the great speeds that, you know, that can be done when you have, you know, all the resources. So I think it's more education. It's more talking about it. It's more, you know, kids should be writing essays about this. Doing the research and reflecting and having school discussions about this. This is, we're talking about their world. We're talking about our world. But you know, by the time they get to our age, the impact will be enormous. Unless we think about it now, and unless we do something about it now. I just want to say, you know, I spent a lot of my youth in the entertainment businesses, in film and video, and some of the publishing business, working in some of the publishing businesses. And for me, you know, what I love about, you know, algorithms, AI, the whole technological disruption is just how much it's done to allow, you know, give youth the freedom to do things, you know, you just couldn't do in my generation.
Lots of benefits,
you know,
again, without a doubt.
I know the show is to talk about the other, but I think there are tremendous opportunities, and, you know, this could be incredible if it's handled properly.
Felton, do you have any final thoughts?
Oh, I was
there?
Just going to say, you know, it's kind of like Google versus the Wikimedia Foundation and how they do things and, you know, what kind of educational benefits either one provides. That would be a great essay for some kid to do.
Yeah.
Thanks to all of you for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us, Mark. Thanks for doing this.
Supervisor of Technology with St. Elizabeth Healthcare, Phil Horney, software architect and developer, Dave Hatter, and Kathy Rubin, founder of CM Rubin World. You can find a link to Kathy's article on AI and biased algorithms at WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.